The Athletic.
Well, you may have noticed something odd this transfer window. Tottenham have a new way of doing deals. They're doing them early, they're bringing in experience, and they're doing it before selling any other players. Now, that's not historically the Daniel Levy way. So what's changed? The Athletic's Tottenham correspondent, Jack Pitt-Brook, and Italian football writer, James Horncastle, are joining us for a dive into their transfer dealings. I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast.
Tottenham fans, would you like some transfer news?
It feels like he's kind of ripped up his playbook that he's relied on for the last 20 years to get to this point.
Tottenham have agreed a deal with Everton to sign Richarlison.
They had to back him, otherwise he would have walked away, I think.
Ivan Perisic is in London today to have a medical.
These two guys, they're just very credible. They're winners.
Strap yourselves in for the ride.
This is how we have to do things now.
All right then, Jack, let's start with you. As you say in your piece, who is the chairman of Tottenham and what has he done with Daniel Levy?
Yeah, it's been a very, very different transfer window for Tottenham so far. Daniel Levy's been running Tottenham since 2000. That's when Enoch bought out Alan Sugar's stake. And I don't really think they've had a window like this, not just in terms of the amount of money they've spent, but the timing they've spent it on, the type of players they've spent it on, signing early in the window, which is something they never used to do, not leaving it to the end, and just kind of throwing their weight around in a way we've never really seen from Tottenham before. So it feels like he's kind of ripped up his playbook that he's relied on for the last 20 years to get to this point.
Did that instruction come from Enoch then? What was the process in leading up to how they have dealt with this transfer window?
Well, I don't think the instruction would have come from Enoch in the sense that Daniel Levy is, I think he can run Tottenham as he sees fit, with the proviso that before this summer, there wouldn't be much money coming in from Enoch. You know, the £150 million injection that they did at the end of last season is something which they hadn't done for a very, very long time. So I think it is down to Levy. I think really it's a reaction to two things. One is the economic circumstances of right now, namely the money they've got coming in from the stadium, Champions League return, and the sense that now is a really good buyer's market. It's a great time to throw your weight around. The other, I think, is the political reality of the pressure that is exerted on Daniel Levy by Antonio Conte and, to a lesser extent, Fabio Paratici, and the sense that Levy has to spend money now, not just to succeed, but also to keep these guys happy, and particularly to keep Conte happy, because he's anxious about what would happen if he doesn't.
We'll come on later to more of Tottenham's finances, and if that doesn't keep you listening, then I don't know what will. James, how much do you put Tottenham's perceived success in this window down to the head coach sporting director relationship?
I don't think Tottenham would have been this aggressive if Nuno was still the coach. I think Conte is very self-aware when it comes to his reputation. He takes very seriously his legacy, which is when clubs appoint me, the fan base, the media expect me to win. And every time I don't win, he feels that very strongly. And so I think at the end of last season, you know, he delivered in getting the club back into the Champions League. But it was very interesting following Conte and Tottenham around that time, because fourth wasn't enough, I think, for Conte. He wanted the ability to push on. He didn't want to be fighting for fourth again. And whenever he's taken a job, he's always said, all I need is just a 1% belief that I can win something here. And, you know, when he turned down the Tottenham job a year ago the first time, one of the readings of that was he didn't believe that there was a 1% chance of Tottenham winning anything. But I think Conte has been aggressive, not in his sort of demeanour or personality, but aggressive in just his will to win. And Paratici is like that as well. I don't know if you've ever had the chance to sit behind Paratici at a game. He kicks every ball in much the same way that Antonio Conte does. He's very animated, very emotionally invested in how well his team does. And so, you know, I think Tottenham had an opportunity, a window with this manager, Conte, that they had to back him. Otherwise, he would have walked away, I think, in the summer. And I think it's because these two guys, Chappers, they're just very credible. They're winners. You know, Conte has got clubs like Siena and Bari promoted into Serie A. He won the Scudetto with Juventus at a time when they hadn't won anything for 9 years, if you go by the Calciopoli ruling, which revoked two titles from them. Yeah, Paratici got Sampdoria to their first cup final in 14, 15 years, got them into the Champions League playoffs, and then recruited for a Juventus team that won the league every year for 9 years. You don't do that with the same team. You rebuild over and over again. He kept them on top. So I think that has put Conte and Paratici in a very strong position when it's come to saying to Daniel Levy and the board at Tottenham to back us.
Do you both think that this is a very Juve transfer window for Tottenham?
Juventus on Thames, as Tottenham are occasionally called in Italy. I think it is to some extent, because I remember following not just Paratici at Juventus after Conte left, but when Conte came back to Italy with Inter, they were very aggressive about going after the players that they wanted, even if it meant selling later, you know, so not kind of raising funds beforehand by selling players that they didn't feel were equipped to play for them and then reinvesting that money later. It's being aggressive, getting the players you want in now, because I think that's another thing that Conte would like, is to have his full quota of players, or as close to the full quota of players, as early as possible, so he gets that full pre-season. Remember, there were stages of last year after he took the Tottenham job where he reminded us all how, I think he'd taken one job in pre-season, in-season before as a kind of caretaker, and he didn't like it because he didn't have that 6 weeks where he could drill the players and get them to understand what he wanted from them. And so I think that informs the transfer strategy. That's why we've seen Tottenham go earlier than they have in the past, because that's what Conte wants. And again, you know, we kind of all know the kind of list of players that Tottenham would like to maybe find new homes for and move out. That was very much the case very early on at Juventus with players like Amaury. It was very much the case at Inter as well with Ragnar Ingelen, Mario Icardi. You knew from the start of pre-season that if it was at Juventus, it was Paratici. If it was at Inter, it was Marotta. They had to move those players out. So I think all of that has informed their transfer strategy.
One of the messages that Conte's had recently has been he wants to get across that what Tottenham are doing now is normal. It's normal for a big club to behave like this. So in the press conference on Saturday after they beat Southampton, Conte was asked about the players the players who they had bought already this summer. And Conte said, "I was really surprised to read that someone was astonished that we signed 6 players early in the window." Now, look, he knows that lots of people, not only me, but others, have said, you know, what an unusual thing for Tottenham to do. But clearly in Conte's mind, this is just what you do. You know, you buy the players you want at the start of the window, so you've got them for pre-season. And this kind of traditional Tottenham policy of, you know, well, we need Gian Moutinho in midfield, but we're only going to try and sign him on the last evening of the transfer window from Porto, and then they don't get it. And then all of a sudden, Tottenham are going into the 2012-13 season without replacement for Luka Modric. Like, that's not really how a big club should behave. So I think Conte's line is, this is actually what we should have been doing all along.
So is that how they persuaded Levy to change that philosophy then? I mean, did they sit down with him and go, look, this, you can't, you say Gian Moutinho then. Let's say in previous windows, if they'd gone for Richarlison in previous windows, you get the impression it would have happened on deadline day because they'd have tried to have knocked 10 million quid off Everton's asking price or whatever it had been. So did they sit down, I don't know, April, May, whatever, and go, look, we have to do this in a different way? Because several people may have tried that with Levy in the past and not succeeded.
I think so, yeah. I definitely have been told that Paratici has been very influential on Levy, and I'm sure Conte has been as well, in terms of impressing on him, this is how we have to do things now. You know, I know that in the past, Levy's had other people in as directors of football, you know, Damian Comolli, Arneson, Baldini, etc. But somebody said to me the other day that Paratici's the most powerful and ruthless director of football that Levy's ever appointed. Like, I think he has a lot more power within the club. Like, Levy, you know, Levy still has a lot of power over transfers. He's still very much involved on this. But Paratici's just a bigger figure, I think, inside the club than those guys. And he really has got Levy's ear on this.
Well, I was reminded of Conte's first season at Inter. I went on tour with them to Singapore and then China. And Conte's first press conference before a friendly. So he'd only been in the job a few weeks. He was saying, guys, we're behind. We're behind schedule on signings. We need to get these deals over the line. Come on. And I remember even some of the Italian press pack around me were surprised that he'd gone so early in raising issues over transfer strategy with Inter's owners, with the board. And I think what Paratici has done this window and Levy is that they've shown that they understand the manager. They understand what he needs, because the only time over this preseason where I've heard Conte kind of go a little bit off message was when he was asked about Jed Spence and he said he's a club signing, perhaps someone who's there to be developed, you know, rather than someone that I have specifically asked the club to sign, because you can see there are certain players. The most obvious is Perisic, someone who he knows. You know, Perisic could have arrived on the last day of preseason. He would already be very well versed in what Conte wants from him. But we haven't really heard Conte feel he has to use the media to accelerate transfer strategy. It's been a very harmonious, coherent way of approaching the market so far. And I, you know, even throughout the last decade of following Conte, it's been a very tranquil summer in that sense. So I think that is credit to Paratici, and obviously credit to Levy as well.
It's a remarkably balanced set of signings, isn't it, Jack? Whether you look at it positionally, you know, they've strengthened each area of the pitch. Whether you look at it positionally, whether you look at experience, promise, players who are Premier League ready. I mean, this could come back to haunt me when they finish seventh and get knocked out of all cups they're in by, before the quarterfinals or whatever. But it looks so balanced what they've done.
Yeah, it really, really is. And they've also done things that they would never do before. Like, for me, I think probably the most interesting one to me is actually Richarlison, just because he's the least Tottenham signing of the lot. Even more than Perisic, who's a 33-year-old who's come in on what, I think at least £180,000 a week on a two-year deal. But Richarlison, they spent 50 plus £10 million on this guy. He's not even immediately in the first team. I know he was suspended for the Southampton game, but he wouldn't have started even if he was fit, because Kulusevski's so good. Like, Richarlison's come in to be a very, very high-level rotation squad player. And for Tottenham to do a deal like that, that's the kind of deal that, you know, Liverpool would do with Diogo Jota, or City would do with Riyad Mahrez. Like, for Tottenham to sign a player like this is completely out of their normal policy. And they are stronger across the pitch. You know, they did have no depth last year. Conte was complaining the other day that they finished the season with basically 13 players. This season, they've got a whole Champions League group stage, which is squeezed into 8 weeks, so they're going to need more depth. So I do think, you know, I know some Spurs fans would like them to have signed one more, like, kind of glamorous player to come straight into the first team. Maybe they will do. I kind of suspect probably not. But the whole squad is definitely much, much, much stronger for having had this window.
I mean, Chappers, I would be very surprised if Tottenham were to finish outside the Champions League places this year, finish seventh.
Oh, so would I, James, but I just felt that I had to cover me. You know what it's like. You just have to cover all bases, don't you?
But I mean, there is this big variable of the World Cup, obviously coming up in November. But, you know, I mean, Spurs' record points total was, I think, what, 86 points under Pochettino. Would not surprise me one bit if that gets broken this year. Just because, you know, I mean, you look at Conte's track record, I think in four of his last six league seasons, he's gone past 86 points. You know, I mean, he set the record in Italy in his final year at Juventus, 102. And that was the year when he felt that Juventus weren't going to win, because Rudy Garcia's Roma won their first 10 league games. And that's one of the contributing factors, I think, why Juventus went out in the group stage of the Champions League that year, because he was like, we have to focus on retaining our title. And then you look at that first year at Chelsea, which as much as people say, okay, he inherited a squad that had won the Premier League the year before last under Mourinho before, as he says, the Mourinho season, 93 points with Chelsea that year in a league that had Jurgen Klopp, in a league that had Pep Guardiola and had Mourinho at Manchester United. So this is a guy who regularly gets into the late 80s, early 90s. If he doesn't, that's kind of off trend for Conte. So I think, yeah, that's why there's a lot of positivity, a lot of optimism, and some people asking themselves the question, can they bridge that gap between City and Liverpool?
I think that has to be the target this year. They have to emulate or beat Pochettino's 86-point record from 2016-17. That was Tottenham's best league season of the modern era. There's no reason, I don't think, why Tottenham shouldn't aim for that this year. Obviously, you know, it's difficult at the start of the season to say we've got to win a trophy because winning a trophy is so contingent on other factors which are out of your control. But I definitely think that should be what their target is. And, you know, maybe that'll be enough for third, maybe it'll be enough for first. It kind of depends how other teams do. But that should definitely be within reach.
Do you think, you mentioned success a lot in the piece. Do you think internally they have set targets maybe away from the points? Do you think they are targeting a trophy? I mean, it'd be a bit odd if they weren't, but do you know what I mean? But to specifically say it.
My sense is that I'm sure Conte would desperately want to win something this season. I imagine that for Daniel Levy, of course he would want to win something, but for the club, you know, staying in the Champions League is of utmost importance. They've got, you know, this is their first season back in the Champions League since 1920. It's fantastic. They've got that full stadium and all that, but they need that indefinitely now. They need that to continue. So I imagine my guess is the club view would be stay in the Champions League, but I'm sure that for Conte's own kind of ego and everything, he would need a trophy.
You are listening to the Athletic Football Podcast with me, Mark Chapman. The big bosses want me to tell you that I'm with you four times a week this season, because apparently that's a positive. I'm sure for a lot of people it won't be. Bringing you the biggest football stories that you need to know about. We'll have more on Tottenham and their Italian connection next. We'll talk about the Italian connection in a moment, but let's do the accounts, Jack. Let's do the info that people are really listening to this podcast for. Stop laughing, Joe. Where is the stadium at with Tottenham's finances in being able to fund a transfer window like this? Is it still a burden? Is it potential? Where are they at with it?
Well, it's definitely a net positive. So the stadium was built with match day revenue in mind. The stadium, I mean, look, it's a fantastic place to watch football. It's also a fantastic place to bring in money on match day. You know, I think I believe that the last figure I heard was they make about £5 million net per home game. And clearly, you know, this was opened in April 2019, the expectation that it would, you know, be open forever, really. Then obviously COVID happened. They didn't have a full home game from March 2020 through to August 2021. And it cost them hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds. Which has really impeded what they can do in the market. Now, obviously, the stadium cost what I think we say £1.2 billion to build. There's hundreds of millions of pounds of debt, which makes that up. But this is all kind of, you know, this is all very much long-term debt. I'm told low interest rates. It's not an immediate burden on Tottenham. So I think the revenue that the stadium brings in far outweighs the cost of the debt. So now that they've had their first full season of a full stadium, they've now got their second full season of a full stadium coming, plus Champions League football this time, I think they are expecting to make a lot of money. And that's before you get to the non-football stuff.
Well, and that's what I was going to come to. I mean, that must be, if not a priority, it must be high up their target list to bring more, you know, Lady Gaga concert type things to the stadium.
Completely, yeah. So this summer they had Guns N' Roses, which I think was a big success. They've had Lady Gaga. They've had boxing in the past. The really big one here is NFL. You know, they've had a lot of NFL games. And I think the dream would be an NFL franchise based at Tottenham. Now, you know more about the NFL than I do, Chappers. Like, I don't know how likely that is. But clearly, you know, the prospect of NFL at Tottenham is a cash cow. The more of that they can get, the more money they can spend on footballers.
But also the more money, I mean, I still think a franchise coming and basing themselves in London still feels like a long way. It felt like it was discussed a lot more maybe 5-10 years ago than maybe it is now, as the NFL broadened out to Germany and Mexico as well. I thought the interesting thing is, I did the Challenge Cup final there not that long ago at the end of May, and historically that has been at Wembley. But it was a much better experience being at the Tottenham Stadium for the Challenge Cup final than it was being at Wembley. The right size, more modern, much more, the acoustics are miles better. I don't know whether they want to do this, because this is the same with the NFL as well, but they can set themselves up as a big rival to Wembley, and it's a much better experience than Wembley, in my opinion.
Yeah. That is really what they sell themselves as, maybe not explicitly, but if you look at the profile of events they have, a profile of events that would normally be at Wembley. And obviously, Tottenham's not great to get to, but neither is Wembley. I don't think either of them particularly stand out for transport connections. Wembley obviously slightly bigger, not hugely bigger. So there's a real opportunity there. And I think the more great stuff that they can have at the stadium, the more money they can make.
Are they going to name it?
Well, they haven't named it yet, and it's been open 3 and a bit years. One thing you hear a bit on this is that, whenever have been in discussions in the past with parties who might be interested in buying a stake in the club, and there is a theory going around that if a company, for example, were to buy 20%, 10% of Tottenham Hotspur, then naming rights could be part of that deal. The fact they haven't done it yet, I don't imagine it would be for lack of interest, because, it's one of the best stadiums in Europe and it's hosting a team which is now very good again. I imagine it's more just to do with the particularities of the deal.
And also, the final thing on the naming thing, Jack, is that it will get called that because it hasn't got any other name. Do you know what I mean? But teams, clubs, when they try and add a sponsor to an existing ground name, tend to have that dropped off. But if it is a new stadium with no name in the past, it gets called by the sponsor's name. Emirates being Emirates, Etihad, Allianz, Aegeus Bowling Cricket. I mean, it's easier if they're new to add a sponsor's name.
Yeah, I actually still say Rose Bowl for
Do
whatever
you?
Reason.
very traditional of you.
Even I don't say Ashburton Grove or City of Manchester Stadium or any of the other names, which generally you only hear if there's like a UEFA competition event there. If there's a UEFA game there, then you have to call it Munich Football Stadium or whatever. Yeah. But you're right, like nobody... Do people say Tottenham Hotspur Stadium? I once got... reminded by the club not to call it New White Hart Lane, and in fact Tottenham Hotspur Stadium was its actual name. So yeah, you're right. If it were all of a sudden to become, I don't know, the Tesla Dome or whatever, then maybe people would start saying that.
The Tesla Dome. Let's go back to their transfer business, James, because there is no doubt that they have not exploited, but they have used their knowledge of the Italian market in particular to bring players in. And I think this is really interesting in football at the moment, because if you know your market and do it well, Tottenham, even Mikel Arteta going back to Manchester City for Gabriel Jesus and Zinchenko, if you use the market that you know and do it well, people praise you. If you try and use the market that you know and make a pig's ear of it, Manchester United, people criticise you for only looking in one market. But they've had huge success going to players that they know from Serie A.
Yeah, they have. Players that they know can cope with being on title-contending teams in high-pressure environments, teams that are expected to get into the Champions League, win derby matches, which everybody tunes in to watch, and also players who know the manager's system or have played in a league which is very tactical with a lot of versatility in it. A lot of teams that play with three at the back, wing backs, everything like that. And also know how a Italian manager works in terms of what you're going to be getting in training every week. Because, I think at Chelsea there were some players who, it was relatively new to be pushed that hard in training. It was relatively new to have to sit through a 90-minute video session one day on how you played and the next day on how your opponents are going to play. It is very intense, but also enriching working under Conte. So they've done that very well. I think Paratici is someone who has as big a contacts book as any sporting director in the game. It's not limited to Serie A. Obviously, that's somewhere he's very familiar with, and I think, you know, he splits his time between the two probably most the two busiest transfer hubs in Europe, which is London and Milan. And he's very
hard life.
Yeah, he's very clued in to what every club is doing, what they need, and you know, I think as much as we've seen them recruit from Serie A with, you know, with the likes of Kulusevski, Bentancur, Perisic, you know, I it wouldn't surprise me if they sell or try to sell to Serie A as well. And again, you know, these guys in a sporting sense are what you need, I think, as title contenders. They are, to borrow that phrase from Succession, where you have, you know, sort of Logan and Kendall, where Logan basically says, you're not a killer. These guys are killers. Conte is a killer in terms of, you know, if you're playing football, you have to kill the game, win the game. And Paratici is very much, if you have to get the deal done, you get the deal done.
The selling point is interesting, Jack, as well, as we sort of wrap all of this up, because Tottenham are similar to a lot of clubs, certainly towards the top end of English football at the moment. They have a lot of players and they have several that they want to move on, I am guessing. And that is easier said than done in this financial climate, as we've discussed many times on the pod.
Yeah, I mean, look, Tottenham have found what everyone else has found this summer, which is that the only place where there's liquidity is the Premier League. You know, the good old days, being able to sell the players you don't want to Germany, Spain, Italy, France, I think are over, really. And so Tottenham have got some pretty good players who they're unable to ship, or they have not been able to ship so far. Lo Celso, Reguilon, and Ndombele and Winks. None of them, Conte didn't even take any of them to the tour in South Korea. None of them even made the bench for the Southampton game. You know, you can accurately describe them, I think, as the bomb squad at Spurs. And yet Spurs can't shift them. I'm sure they will end up doing loan deals for probably all four of them, unless they're minded to take very cut price fees. And yeah, and that makes it difficult. But the good thing is that Spurs haven't been stuck in the kind of sell to buy cycle which they've had in the past, you know, back in the sort of peak Pochettino years, when admittedly they were paying for this fantastic new stadium, they wouldn't sign anyone because they couldn't sell anyone. Whereas now, they do the buying first and worry about the selling later, which I think makes things a bit easier.
If you want to get more on Spurs from The Athletic, make sure you listen to the View from the Lane podcast with Danny Kelly. That's out twice a week. Jack, you're on that as well. Is that a better podcast than this one, would you say?
It's a different tone.
That's a brilliantly diplomatic answer, and I have no idea whether that's a compliment or not. Before we let James go, just give me an update on Adrian Rabiot, will you? I'm just, you know, regular listeners to this podcast will know my cynicism and general world weariness around United.
Well, I described him.
Why? I mean, who, what, why, when?
Well, I think what's interesting about this chap is that if you look at some of the players that they've gone for in the last week, and what a week it's been, you've got Marko Arnautovic, who is represented by his brother, so not a big agency. And then you've got Adrian Rabiot, who's represented by his mother. Again, not a big agency, not intermediaries involved. So it's not like these deals are agent-driven. Yeah, this is United being proactive about liking these players, targeting these players, which then begs the question, you know, what is it that these players, what is it that these executives and this coaching staff admire in these players? And, you know, I mean, Rabiot, I wrote about this on the site earlier this week. Yeah. There's this paradox about him, which is that he starts almost every game for Juventus. And there are players who don't, who people think are silky, talented. Artur, for example, who was swapped for Pjanic, came from Barcelona. And Rabiot always gets picked for France as well when he's not in dispute with the coach. So what? Yeah, these very good coaches, Maurizio Sarri, Pirlo, Allegri, Didier Deschamps, they clearly see something in this player that they value. But for fans and media sort of watching and judging Rabiot, they see a player who's very tall, elegant, left-footed. But what does he contribute? He doesn't score. He doesn't assist. He doesn't create chances for your team.
Does he dictate the tempo of a game? Because no. that arguably is what United need in their midfield more than anything else. Somebody who can dictate when to slow it down, when to speed it up, when to just keep possession.
He's technically sound, but he's not someone you would run a game through. For example, at Juventus, ever since Pjanic left, that has been the issue. Where is the metronome in our midfield who's going to sort of speed it up or slow it down? I kind of made the forced kind of comparison in my piece with, you know, if you cross Timothy Chalamet with Scott McTominay, you get Adrian Rabiot. So look, you know, let's see what happens. I think I think the way to explain it is if the manager sees this player as someone who is functional and can help the rest of the team become bigger than the sum of its parts, then there's justification for it. At the same time, Juventus fans will tell you that Rabiot, along with Aaron Ramsey, became symbols of Juventus' decline in midfield because. And they are Fabio Paratici signings. You know, we've come full circle here. And you know, Juventus had a really good run of recruiting in free agency, if you like. It all turned around for them when they got Pirlo for free from AC Milan. He was the guy who turned them from being a team that finished outside the Champions League places to one that won the league in his first year. Pogba was a game changer in that he made the club a load of money whilst also being really good, and they could reinvest that money and be killers in the transfer market by signing Gonzalo Higuain from Napoli and Miralem Pjanic from Roma, their two biggest rivals. And then it ended essentially with Ramsey and Rabiot because Juventus have been so good at recruiting for their midfield, which had, you know, Marchisio, Pirlo, Vidal. And then it was Pjanic, Kadira, and it kind of ended with Rabiot and Ramsey. So I think Juventus fans, were this deal to go through, they would say, okay, get 15, 20 million for a player, get him off the wage bill because he's been one of the highest earners. They would see that as a good deal for them. You know, it remains to be seen whether it's a good deal for United or not.
We'll have to end it there. Jack, I love talking to you. James, I love talking to you until the last 10 minutes. But there we go.
Why didn't United appoint Conte? I mean, just look how quickly he's turned Spurs around.
Oh, my. Don't make it even worse, sorry, James. Jack, goodness me. Yeah, I know. Right. Jack, James, thank you very much. Good to have you both on.
Pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Remember that for the very latest on Tottenham, and indeed every Premier League team, you can head to The Athletic and subscribe for just £1 a month for the first 6 months. Just go to theathletic.com/footballpod.
The Athletic.